D.T. Max wrote the first biography of the late celebrated writer David Foster Wallace, who committed suicide several years ago. It's called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. Among the surprises about Wallace's life, he wasn't just a novelist and essayist, he was also a prolific writer of letters. Max told Steve Paulson there's no mistaking Wallace's writing voice in a book or a personal note.
David was always who he was, and always who he was, especially when he wrote. In the same way that, you know, Infinite Jest, the same voice is operating in Infinite Jest, although altered in many different ways, as the same voice that you also find in, say, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. So when you look at the letters, you do find that there's really only one person who could have written the letters. There's a wonderful letter he writes apologizing at some point for having tried to buy a gun, true story, to kill Mary Carr's husband. And this letter, you know, has the weirdest syntax in it. And so here he is writing this letter basically apologizing for the worst day of his life and the worst decision he ever made. And he's still using that marvelous, strange David Foster Wallace syntax. It was how he wrote. It's how he thought. He couldn't get away from it.
Now, one category of letter is David talking with other writers and with his editors. And he sometimes has voluminous correspondence. Could you pick out one? Read a portion for us?
Sure. David had a wonderful, vibrant relationship with the editor, Jerry Howard, who was his first editor at Penguin Books, a very, very capable and literate man. So here's just a little section in a wonderfully argued letter entitled Spontaneous Memo, all in caps. So he says, as you said, and it made an enormous, haunting impression on me, there is such a thing as a physics of reading, a whole set of readers' values and tolerances and capacities and patience levels to take into account when the gritty business of writing stuff for others to read is undertaken. I am at this point totally lost about how and where to compromise between what are some really serious, and I mean deadly serious, I am young and confused and obsessed with certain problems that I think right now distill into the experience of being human in a human community, concerns of mine, and the physics of the reading of readers who are hopefully going to shell out hard-earned money to be entertained and or edified by a piece of attempted literature. Writers whose whole concerns are the physics of reading interest me not at all, but clearly pieces in which there is no such concern. Kafka's Investigations of a Dog leaps to mind. That's a wonderful phrase, that the dog leaps to mind, are artistic disasters. I don't want to be Ayn Rand or late Günter Grass or Pynchon at his rare worst. Can you help me with this? I just love that letter. I mean, there's so many feints and dodges and presentations of self. And that parenthesis. Imagine being an editor expecting to discuss text and getting a parenthetical phrase, and I mean deadly serious.
Now, one of the things that comes out in your biography of David Foster Wallace is that he was not only brilliant, he was just incredibly troubled emotionally, psychologically. He was in and out of mental institutions, had numerous breakdowns, had electroshock therapy at a certain point. He talked quite openly about this. He wrote about it in a number of his letters. What do we learn from him through his letters about the agony that he suffered?
You know, he does talk with more people than you would expect about having electroshock or being in an institution, you know, for a period of time. But he's certainly shy about them. I mean, it's by no means the first thing he says. I mean, there are plenty of letters where he sort of answers evasively to the implicit question, like, why am I at Granada House? You know, he's there because he's an alcoholic. But he only to a handful of people does he say that. But more than you would expect, there's actually a kind of courage that's evident in David's letters. So if you'd like, what comes to mind is a letter he wrote to John Franzen in May of 1990 that I quote in my book.
If you could read that, that'd be great.
Yeah. Basically, he stood Franzen up. Franzen wanted to see him in Boston and knew the conditions under which David was now. David had, you know, he'd written Boom of the System. He'd written a short story collection. He'd had a breakdown at Harvard where he'd begun as a philosophy student. And he was sent to McLean, the psychiatric hospital, and from there to a halfway house fictionalized in Infinite Jest as Ennett House. But the real truth is that he could not write when he first got there. He was detoxing, and he was discombobulated. He was just disoriented. So John tries to visit him, and David basically stands him up because he doesn't want to be seen in this condition. He does not want to be seen as the shell of the writer he was, and he's a whopping, 28 years old, so it's even more embarrassing for David Foster Wallace to, you know, to think of himself as over the over the hill when most writers are just getting started. So here's his explanation. I think it's quite lovely about why he's not writing anymore. "I have in the last 2 years been struck dumb. I do not know why, but your letters often have an eerie way of orbiting what I suspect are reasons. I remember a strange note from you asking about how I'd reacted to the attention, both plus and negative, of my first book coming out, about how writing out of vocation as an even semi-public person was different and or scarier than writing for personal pleasure, and then fantasizing about getting it published. I'm sure I wrote back some pious stuff about integrity and not forgetting what's at the heart of the enterprise and all that. It was lies. It's affected me deeply. But I don't know how to articulate how. As with so many other things that have become important to me, I have been struck dumb here. Not dumb, actually, or even aphasic. It's more like WRT, you know, with respect to, that was a Wallace abbreviation, WRT, things I used to believe and let inform me, my thoughts now have the urgent but impeded quality of speechlessness in dreams, a kind of soul stutter. Even this sounds too flowery. But what's important to me is that this same muteness afflicts my ability to defend, even think about, certain beliefs I used to have about art, and art in tension with rules and received ideas and social cultural atmospheres." So in other words, he's saying not only has this aphasia taken away my ability to write, it's also taken away my ability to understand why I used to write. That's what I love about that, those two paragraphs. There's just so much in them.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask, I mean, David Foster Wallace had a very tempestuous personal life, complicated relationships with lots of women, and it would seem that perhaps the most complicated of all was with Mary Carr herself, a very well-known memoirist, also a fellow—
Not at the time.
Not at the time, but later. Fellow addict in recovery. Wallace was pursuing her for a long time, starting when she was still married. I guess they had quite a big correspondence through letters, right?
Yeah, I don't know if she wrote him much. For me, otherwise, it's David reaching out, you know, and nothing coming back. It's one of the artifacts of reading somebody's letters. So I don't know if Mary wrote to him a great deal or not. I mean, he wrote to her all the time. He used, you know, I mean, frankly, he was one of David's, you know, instruments of seduction was reasonably enough language, you know, written language. And he knew where he and where and how he seemed most sexy. And it certainly wasn't, you know, being on the phone and whining. It was producing a beautiful little piece of prose that could hardly not, you know, stir anyone to feel romance and so on. You know, there's just one little section I read from a letter from Mary Carr, which is that...
From her or to her?
I'm sorry, I misspoke, to Mary Carr. Mm-hmm. This is one that's contextless but sort of wonderful, and you have to see the letter because it looks sort of like David cut out some of the words sort of stalker-like and pasted them in, but actually I think he just used a huge type font. Anyway, the letter goes, "Marry me." Then it continues, "No," and then I think a word we can't use on radio, but you get the idea, "No, blank, Mary Carr, do not doubt my seriousness on this. Or the fact that I'm a Gila-jawed bulldog once I finally made a commitment, a promise. My expectation is not that it would be easy or all the time pleasant. My expectation is that it would be real and illuminated." I just love that. I'm not sure
What was that phrase of with the bulldog again?
A Gila-jawed bulldog.
Wow.
Yeah, like a Gila monster-jawed bulldog. Like not just a bulldog, but a Gila-jawed bulldog, which, I mean, personally... I'm not a woman, but I'm not sure I want that in a life's companion. I might want you to be able to release the grip from time to time.
Yeah, I mean the intensity is kind of overwhelming, isn't it?
Overwhelming, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of those things where you have to preface it by saying, you know, don't try this at home. David was, you know, a genius whose intensity in some ways is sort of burningly attractive.
Now, his last words, presumably. Came in the, I think it was a 2-page letter he wrote to his wife,
right.
Karen Green,
yeah.
who was the one who found him after he'd
right.
committed suicide.
Right.
So I take it you have not seen the final letter he wrote to his wife.
No, and I feel very strongly that there are things, you know, I'll give you an example. When I originally wrote the draft of Every Love Story That Goes Straight, wrote the last scene, I included a fair number of details from his suicide that I later felt were just unnecessary. And just didn't, you know, I felt they were voyeuristic. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the death could be told very simply because all deaths are the same death in a way. And so between the advance reading copy, you know, the pre-publication version given to reviewers and the finished book, I trimmed out a lot of information that, you know, was in the earlier version about the suicide. And I mean, I'm glad I did. I think when you deal with a really momentous and upsetting and emotionally super packed moment, you know, I, at least as a writer, I don't try and tease out every last ounce of pathos from it, you know. On the contrary, I trust you as the reader to read it the way you want it to read it. And to some extent that would extend, you know, I mean, the things that I do know about the suicide note are not, you know, in the book, don't seem to me necessary for an understanding of David and his life. I mean, you know, he was also a person under immense psychological stress in those last moments. So I don't think what we're talking about here is a letter, you know, the way these wonderful letters were written in the more moderate discomfort of, you know, trying to create a wonderful first novel for Gerald Howard or trying to explain to John Franzen, you know, why it is he can't write. You know, we're just talking about a whole different, we're talking about a moment, frankly, where words, you know, really don't suffice.
D.T. Max is the author of Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, the first biography of writer David Foster Wallace. He spoke with Steve Paulson.